Ladies and gentlemen, we're on page 20B. In English, it's 20B2. 20B2. Tanu Rabbanan. We take up a somewhat different subject than what we have been reading until now. We are going to expand a little bit on the notion of Shiv'ah. And the Gemara is going to teach us who is it that is, for whom do you mourn? How do we know when you are a mourner and for whom actually do you mourn? Mourning means that the laws of Shiva apply to you. Okay? Tanu Rabbanan. Okay, this is now going to be a Beraita. The rabbis taught in a Beraita. Kol ha'amur b'farashat kohanim shekohen mitame lahem avel mitabel aleihem. Every one who is mentioned in the parsha about the kohanim, the priests, where it says that a kohen is mitame lahem, that a kohen may, or in fact it probably means here, must become ritually impure for these people, avel mitabel aleihem, a mourner mourns for those same people. For those same people. Now, what's that referring to? Perfect timing. Perfect timing. It's this week's Parsha. It's the first words of this week's Parsha, of Parshat Emor. The Parsha says, Vayedaber Hashem Moshe Lemor. Vayomer. Daber al Aharon vel banav. So now the focus is on Aaron and his sons. Speak to them, saying, V'yinazru mikodshe... I'm in the wrong place. That's chapter 22. Vayomer Hashem Moshe Emor el Kohanim. The Lord says to Moses, say to the Kohanim, B'nei Aharon, the children of Aaron, V'amarta leyam, you shall say to them, L'nefesh lo yitama be'amav, you may not defile yourself for death among your people. So that is to say that a Kohen cannot willingly put himself in a position where he becomes Tameh. All right? He cannot do that. Ki im li she'ero akarov elav, except for the she'er which is near to him. I won't translate that yet. Le'imo, to his mother, ula'aviv, to his father, ul'vilivno, ulevito, uleachiv, to his son, his daughter, and his brother. Ulachoto habetula hakrovailav, and to his literally virgin sister, who is near to him. Asher lo ayetal ish layitama, who is not married, he may defile himself for her. Lo yitama bal bi'amav lahechalo. Well, it's hard to know exactly what that means. A ba'al, a husband, may not defile himself bi'amav. I don't know what that means. Here it's translated as a kinsman by marriage, lahechalo, to so profane himself. So not at all clear what the end of this means. The rest of it is pretty clear. What this is saying is that Kohanim are not allowed to defile themselves. That means to become Tameh, to willingly put themselves in a situation where they will become Tameh, and that situation is to come in contact with death. Either to come in direct contact with death or indirect contact with death. Because remember that one can become Tameh not only from touching a corpse, but even by inhabiting the same space as a corpse. Inhabiting the same space as a corpse means inhabiting a contiguous space with a corpse. So that, for example, if, God forbid, there were a met in the social hall of this building, we would all be tamed from that met. Okay, so that is the nature of this thing. It moves around through spaces.
I once heard a discussion whether a Kohen astronaut would become Tamei if he passed over cemeteries.
That must have been quite a discussion. It's one of those late night things. I used to listen also when I was, before I got married, I used to listen in the middle of the night to these people who reported about flying saucers that had landed. Did you ever hear those things in the middle of the night? Up 2-3 o'clock in the morning. I always had these people on the radio. I was listening to the radio, who had been in Martians flying saucers. You know. So that's the same people who discuss that, in my humble opinion. Okay. I'm so charitable. Okay. So these are the Kohanim that the Kohanim have this restriction, but it is released for certain close family members. They're released from the restriction for certain close family members. And they are, the first one that's mentioned is Ki'im li she'era karov elav. That's a very hard thing to translate. I'll do it literally. Ki'im, except for, she'er. You know what she'er means?
Remnant, right?
But it doesn't mean that. It's what it should mean, but it doesn't mean that. She'er means flesh. Flesh. I have no idea why, but that's what it means. She'er means flesh. So it means, except for his flesh, which is close to him. Then, if I were just reading this, I would think there was a colon after that. And then it would say, colon, what does that mean? Le'imo, his mother, his father, his son, his daughter, his brother, and then the unmarried sister. Right? The assumption, by the way, with a married sister is, the notion of marriage in the Bible is, that essentially she leaves the family, she goes to his to her husband's family. The tribe changes, the locale changes, so that's why she's in a different position there. But that the way I just translated this is not the way it is understood by the Talmud. Instead, she'ero karov elav is the first in the list, not followed by a colon, but the flesh that is close to him, meaning his wife. That's why it means his wife. Now here it's translated, how they translated here, about whom it is. Who is closest to him. Alright, well it doesn't say that. It means the flesh who is near to him, literally. So that means, according to the Talmud, his wife. So it goes then, his wife, his mother, his father, his son, his daughter, his brother, and the unmarried sister. Okay, so those are the ones that, as I say, it's not only that you are permitted, but in fact you're obligated, because you are obligated to deal with this. And therefore, those are the key players who are the ones who are close to you. So to go back to the Braita, Kol Amor Befarshat Kohanim. Everyone who is mentioned in this Parashat HaKohanim, in this section about the Kohanim at the beginning of Emor, Shekohen Mitamelahem, where the Kohen is defiled for their sake when they die, Avel Mitamelahem. Someone mourns for those same people. For those same people. Okay? Ve'eluhin. Then it spells it out. Ishto, the first one was she'era karov elav, the flesh that is near to him, and that is Ishto. Aviv, of course, Ishto, you would wonder whether this is exclusively Ishto, whether it works the other way around. Does a woman mourn similarly for her husband? And the answer is yes. This is considered to be interchangeable. Now, there's no difference here. Aviv imo, even though, of course, the truth is she'ero karov elav doesn't mean his wife, just means the flesh who is close. And of course it's being directed at the Kohanim, so it has to be in the male, because the male Kohanim are in a special position. They're the ones who were officiating. Okay? Ve'elu en ishto, aviv imo, achiv, his brother, his sister, his son, and his daughter. Now, the English adds a few words here. These are his wife, his father's mother, his paternal brother, his paternal virgin sister, his son, and his daughter. That is, again, the Kohen line. The rabbis are assuming that, even though that doesn't appear in the language. We know that they're assuming it because of what is going to follow in just a moment, because they're going to expand the category to include the maternal. So obviously they're reading it to include only the paternal relatives of this at this level. Okay? Correct, they did have polygamy. His paternal brother, his paternal virgin sister, his son and his daughter. Hosifo alehen, they added to these, that means the rabbis added to these, who are the biblical ones, achiv achoto abetulameimo, his brother and the unmarried sister from the mother. So obviously what was understood before was from the father, so they add to that from the mother. The achoto nesua and his married sister, bein me'aviv, bein me'imo, whether paternal or maternal. Okay? Now the baraita goes on. The baraita goes on. Uchushem shemitabel aleihem. Just as he observes mourning for them, kach mitabel al shni'im shalahem. Very interesting, right? So he also mourns for their seconds. Their seconds. Now this is a technical term that you lawyers, I'm sure, deal with, in the state law, who is a relative, and what are the names of the different relatives. In Jewish law, a sheni, in most cases, means somebody who is then, I don't know how you say it, secondary relative? How do you say that in English? You have terms for that? Once removed, maybe that's the term. Once removed is like on the tree, one over. Okay? Although it's not absolutely clear.
You mean like a half-brother, a half-sister?
No, it wouldn't mean a half-brother or a half-sister. Right. It would mean, for example, the son of a brother.
A nephew or a nephew.
Oh. Okay, the son of a brother, let's say. That could be.
That's a nephew, right.
Son of a brother is a nephew. It could be more distant than that, though. Let's say...
The son of a cousin.
Son of a cousin.
Is the cousin once removed.
Son of a cousin is... But you don't have to mourn for a cousin.
Right.
So that wouldn't be that. So it would be. It could be a grandchild.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It could be a grandchild. It could be a grandparent. Let's see.
What about an in-law?
That's an interesting possibility. It could be an in-law. We'll have to explore that possibility because in theory, that could be.
Seems unlikely.
But in theory, it's possible.
It's under the paper.
It's a variety.
Well, it depends whether anybody else sits shiver for their in-law or not.
It wouldn't make any difference. because we say here, Kshem Shemitabel Aleihem, if he mourns for these people who are specified, Kach Mitabel Al Shni'im Shalahem, so he mourns for those who are their secondaries.
I don't understand, Rabbi Wexler. If a normal mourner doesn't have to mourn them, why should a Kohen have to mourn them?
No, it means a normal mourner would have to mourn. This is telling us that a normal mourner would have to mourn.
They're bringing in a chiddush.
Yeah. It's a chiddush. To them, that's...
That's not what we learned before.
We didn't learn anything before. We haven't looked at this before. I know why you're doing what you're doing, because you know that we don't do this.
Yeah.
But that doesn't matter that we don't do it. Maybe we're wrong. Or maybe something happened in the meantime. Okay? And of course, when you read a baraita, it's not only one point of view in a baraita. We have only read the beginning of the baraita. This is the Tana Kamma in the baraita. This is the first position of the first Tana in the baraita, and we know who that Tana is. Divrei Rabbi Akiva. This is Rabbi Akiva. This is Rabbi Akiva's opinion that we have read so far. Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar Omer, Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar says, Eino mitabel ela al ben beno v'alavi aviv. Right? He only mourns, yes, we do go a second level, but the grandchild or the grandfather. Okay? Those are the only two where we go to the seconds. We don't say as far as the brother or sister goes that their children, for example, you would mourn for. We don't say that. We only go for the father and the child. We go one additional. Okay?
Not the grandmother.
The grandmother would be the same. The grandmother would be in the same position as the grandfather. Okay? So, but it's just that level. It's just in the parental level and the child level as opposed to the brother and sister level or the wife level, wife and husband level. Right? Because the wife and the husband, they have parents too. So, you know, in theory, one might have thought that, according to Rabbi Akiva, you would do that. According to Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar, you wouldn't do that. Okay? Eino mitabel ela al ben beno v'al avi aviv. The Chachamim Omrim. Oh, finally, we'll see what the opinion of the sages is. Kol shemitabel alav mitablim imo. Mitabel imo, sorry. Anyone who mourns for him, mitabel imo, they mourn with him. Right? Anyone who has an obligation to mourn if he were to die, okay, anyone who would have such an obligation, would go, it would flip. It would go the other way around also. Let's just see the note here. Mm-hmm. Want to read the note?
Well, the translation actually says anybody who would be mourning with him, in other words, if you were both sons of the same father, so you would be mourning together, you would be sitting shiva together, then you would have to sit shiva for each other.
That's correct.
Why does the Brit assume that the Torah text only refers to paternal?
I think the reason is because since it's directed at the Kohanim, and since the Kohen line is a paternal line, that is the reason for its assumption. Okay? Let's just see if there's the note 25. That is, if an immediate relative, I'm reading number 25, if an immediate relative for whom he would himself mourn were then to die, that is, if an immediate relative for whom he would himself mourn were they to die, sustains the loss of a relative and is mourning, he mourns along with him. He mourns along with him. Right? Now, as the note says, the Gemara will immediately note, this would seem to be the same as Rabbi Akiva. It's basically the same view that Rabbi Akiva has stated right at the beginning, that one mourns for the immediate relatives of one's immediate relatives. That's in effect the same thing. It's in effect saying the same thing. Okay, but it's just saying it's slightly different. So the Gemara says, Chachamim hainu tanakama. The sages are saying the same thing as the first Tana. The first Tana is Rabbi Akiva. So they must have the same point of view. Ika benai ho imo babayi. The difference between the Tanakama and the sages is the question of whether the mourning for that secondary relative is limited to babayit, to when you and that relative are in the same home, when you are in the same home. Ki hadi amar le Rav lechia berei, as Rav said to Chia his son, v'chein amar le Rav huna le Rava berei, so Rav Huna said to Rabbi his son, Biapa nahog aviluta. In front of her, in other words, in your wife's presence, when she is mourning for a relative, then you should mourn too. Below apa lotin hog aviluta. When you are not in the same presence, without her being in your presence, then you don't observe mourning. So here the issue is, apparently they're saying that there's two different points of view here, it's not obvious how it comes out of the text, but there apparently were two points of view, and they really turn around. While there is such an obligation to mourn for the people that you would mourn for, one distance away, when they are mourning, you have to mourn for them. That apparently is limited to when you are in their presence. When you are in their presence. So that means, for example, if mourners can't wash, if you are out of the house, you go to work, you can wash. When you're in the house, you can't wash. So that much of what this is doing is really setting up a reality which is a home-based reality, where in fact you are acting responsive to the person that you are close to and not doing things that would just seem inappropriate. Now I must say, we'll read in a minute the note that explains more about this, but the fact is that any of you who have had this experience know that this is something that occurs to you. When you are at home with a mourner, you don't want to do things that seem inappropriate. Mm-hmm. And in effect, you kind of want to do the same thing that the mourner is doing. Husbands and wives will often feel that way, you know, that it's just you don't want to do things in front of your husband or your wife which they can't do themselves. And that's a very common feeling that you have, and I think that's really what's being reflected here. That's the notion that's being reflected here. So it's limited, and it obviously has to do with the kavod, with the honoring of the person that you're close to. And that honoring has to do with the honoring of the person that they were close to, of course, that they lost. But in fact, you're constricted by that as well for practical reasons. Having said that, let's read 26. According to Rabbi Akiva, he is obliged to mourn for a secondary relative, even if his immediate relative is not present. But according to the sages, mourning for a secondary relative is undertaken only out of respect for his immediate relative. That's what I just said. And need be observed only in his presence. Okay? So the husband and wife, the wife is mourning. The husband has to observe those things at home that seem to be appropriate for the honor of the spouse.
But he doesn't say that he's supposed to stay at home for 7 days.
He doesn't. He doesn't have to. According to the sages, he doesn't have to. According to Rabbi Akiva, he has to. That is what the Gemara is saying is the difference between the Tanakhama, Rabbi Akiva, and the Chachamim, the sages. As I said, I can't tell you how they derived that from the text. It's not at all obvious. But there must have been these two different traditions. One tradition said, and that's why they're saying that they're both reflected in these two different statements, or the two different statements wouldn't be in the same baraita. There must have been a tradition which was that, in fact, the secondary relatives have to mourn, and have to mourn exactly the same way as the primary relatives. That was the point of view of Rabbi Akiva. And the point of view of the sages, the Chachamim, is that you don't have to do that. You can go out, you can go to work, you can do all those things, but when you are in the presence of the mourner, you act as if you're a mourner.
But even if you're in the same room, I've never seen a spouse sit...
I didn't say we do this.
We don't do it.
Oh, well, the reason why I'm jumping ahead is because it says the halakha follows the view of the sages.
Wait a minute, okay. Hold on. Have to have patience. Have to have patience. Okay?
All right.
Thus, for example, he is required to mourn for his father's father only in the presence of his father. That's what we just said. That's the sage's point of view. Tosafot ponder whether presence here means actually in the same room as the mourner or simply being in the same house. That's what the Tosafot would do. He made a living doing that. Okay. The halacha follows the view of... Wait, let me tell you. I had a lunch with somebody the other day who has a nephew. And I had met this nephew in Jerusalem. So I said, how does your nephew make a parnasa?
what?
A parnasa. Oh. A parnasa, and a living. How does he make a living? How does he make a living? Because he's a rabbi of a synagogue. I davened in his synagogue. So I therefore asked, how does he make a parnasa? Because at that synagogue, you can't make a parnasa. So I said, how does he make a parnasa? He says, oh, from his sforim. I said, oh, his sforim. What sforim did he write? He says, he has 42 volumes. 42 volumes. He wrote 42. I said, what did he write? He says, you don't know the book? I said, I guess not. He says, it's Mei Menuchot is the name of the book that he wrote 42 volumes. He's not finished yet. On the Tosafot. 42 volumes to explain what the Tosafot are saying. So the Tosafot has made a living. This guy makes a parnasa on the Tosafot. Except the only problem is that nobody knows about his book, all 42 volumes. It must have sold 3 copies. But I guess if you have 42 volumes and you sell 3 copies, you can make a parnasa, as long as you don't need much of a parnasa. Okay, to go back to the subject. The Lacha follows the view of the sages that one mourns for a secondary relative only out of respect for his immediate relative and only in his presence. Okay, that's the Lacha. Moreover, get this, this is the key thing now. If his immediate relative is willing to forego the respect due him, one need not mourn even in his presence. For this reason, the practice of mourning for secondary relatives has fallen altogether into disuse, since it is assumed that the immediate relative is willing to forego this show of respect. So in fact, halacha today is we don't do any of these things. We don't do any of these things. But obviously, it was considered to be obligatory even during the time of the Shulchan Aruch. It's post-16th century that the laws changed as far as the practice goes.
As you say, the inclination is anyway.
Correct. There's a natural inclination, I think, to do these things. But it's no longer, I mean, the force of practice, the force of law no longer falls on this. It's just because the community's practice has changed. Interesting.
Have you ever seen anybody or heard of anybody asking, you know, do you want this respect?
No, it's never
done.
Never.
You don't give the person the option.
No, because it's generally assumed. That's what he is saying.
Is it perceived as usurping? Sort of like it's my mourning, not your mourning, because it's my mother, not your mother?
No, it's just considered to be very, in a number of areas of halacha where kavod is relevant, the tendency of a law is to encourage people to forgo the honor that is due them, that we shouldn't stand on ceremony with other people. I remember Dr. Finkelstein, when he was a chancellor of the seminary, the thing that always used to impress particularly the lay people, and we had gotten used to it as students, but Dr. Finkelstein would never go into the elevator first. He would always stand and hold the elevator door open for everybody else, and he would walk. He was mochel al kvodo. That was to teach the students, we learned, that you should always be, as rabbis, you should always be mochel al kvodcha. Even though you are due kavod, you should never hold anybody up for the kavod. That was his message. So that's a general tendency in the halacha, is to encourage mechilat kavod.
Is there a contradiction here? Because last week, I think, in the Shmua Merachok, Rabbi Akiva gave a more lenient rule about only one day of Shiva. The Chachamim said, even if it's Shmua Merachok, 7 days. And then it had a comment, when the majority are more stringent, we follow the rule of the majority. Here, Rabbi Akiva would appear to be more stringent. It requires that you avail for secondary relatives, whether you are in the same house even if, or not. Mm-hmm. The Chachamim say, no, it's only if you're in the same house.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's a good point. I would explain it.
Follow the rule of the Chachamim.
I would explain the following way. That point of view, if you remember, which said that you go according to the lenient position, was Shmuel's position. Shmuel lived about 80 years after Rabbi Akiva. So what I would conclude is that Rabbi Akiva didn't have a consistent point of view about always taking the lenient position, but within 80 years after that, Shmuel speaks then for what came to be the position of the rabbis in general, to always accept the lenient position. Sometimes, therefore, it was Rabbi Akiva's position, sometimes it was not Rabbi Akiva's position. Okay? So I don't think that Rabbi Akiva has to be consistent on that score, because he didn't utter that principle. He just had the lenient point of view. In that particular case. The principle is an Amoraic principle, which is, as I say, after the time of Rabbi Akiva.
Contemporary situation that I see that people might want to make an exception would be a grandparent or a grandchild. If such a situation were to arise now, what do you think the
We shouldn't do it.
We shouldn't
depart from the custom that has come to be accepted as far as these things go. Because when you do that, in a way you're saying everybody else doesn't love their grandchild the way you do. Or you're making a statement by the different action that you are expressing. So I don't think that we want to encourage that. I think that we want to, in effect, give into the conformity of the community in order not to make statements. Basically, the community sets the standards. That's what I would say. Yes.
If you don't mind, a conceptual question. Where in this case does the Torah reason the connection between death and Tameh?
Death and Tameh is not reasoned. It is assumed. In the book of Leviticus, it is assumed that the source of Tum'ah, Avi Avot HaTum'ah, is a dead body, is a mit.
Why?
Because that is the essence of Tum'ah. Essence of Tum'ah comes from death. Death is the principal source of, it is the source of Tum'ah. It is probably the source of nearly all Tum'ah comes from death. You can't ask why. The fact is that, then you can say, well, what is there about death? And you can see, therefore, death is the prime evil that really can contaminate the holy space. Now, the people who have studied history of religion, everybody knows that death is the danger. It's the great danger in human life. Our greatest fear is of death. And that the problem is that death has a certain power to it. And what you are doing with this is really limiting death. Death has certain limits. It has and the holy space has to be protected from it. The holy space is a space of life and not death, and therefore death has to be kept out of the holy space. Because in the Jewish symbol system, life takes precedence over death. Therefore, the holy space is a life space, not a death space.
And also the Egyptians were a religion of death.
Right. It's also true of the Egyptians. Egyptians were a religion of death. If you look at this parsha, the best way to understand this parsha is in light of the Egyptians. Mm-hmm. Because these are the Kohanim. Right? The Egyptian priests were priests of death. The Jewish priests are told, you can't deal with that kind of stuff. That's off limits to you guys. And then there's an exception made for your close relatives. But otherwise, as far as ministering goes, you have to minister differently.
Thank you. There was no life after death. One way of dealing with the horror of it is to say that this is just a transitional phase. So actually, the death is the introduction to life after death.
In which case, for the Egyptians or for?
No, the Egyptian religion, right. Christian religion.
Correct. It's true that in the Bible you really don't have that. I'm not saying they don't have that in Judaism. In fact, we have that in Judaism. But we don't have it in the Bible. It's a later idea. But the Bible, you're quite right. Alan first.
Who says that one need not mourn if the immediate relative is willing to forego the respect due him? Is that the Shulchan Aruch?
No, that's after the Shulchan Aruch.
And it's secondary to custom that
Correct.
Developed.
Correct.
So,
Among the things, the Ramah is quoted there. I haven't looked up the Ramah, but the Ramah, remember, is the Ashkenazi commentary on the Shulchan Aruch. So that becomes, it actually is Shulchan Aruch, but it's not Rabbi Yosef Karo.
So a general question, which I don't know whether you want to answer this, but like, having the Orthodox deal with like change that is being done by the community now, or that is asked by the general community now, when they say it can't be done, well, when in the history of Judaism, it's been done all the time.
The truth is that kind of argument is a false argument. It's not a true argument. And anybody who is a good Orthodox Jew knows it. You know, anybody who's scholarly and understands knows that. So it's part of the rhetoric of modern Jewish life. Most of the rhetoric of modern Jewish life has little basis in truth or reality, in case you thought otherwise. And it's true across the board. It's true, it's the conservative rhetoric about the Orthodox has no basis in truth. If you examine what it says, it's not true. The Orthodox says about the no, the conservatives also has no basis in reality. There are things that are true. I'm not saying there are no truths, but I'm saying that basically the rhetoric is mostly false. Mostly false. So that kind of rhetoric is just not true. And they know that. They know that. But the rhetoric is based on something else entirely. It is, how do you preserve the tradition in the modern world? That's where it comes from. And that is a real issue. That is a real issue. And on that issue, there are vastly different takes. And as a result of a take on that issue, the facts are distorted according to the way you'd like to see them. Okay? So that any Orthodox scholar knows that, particularly read this chapter. This chapter is a chapter of custom and the development of custom and custom that changes, and nobody knows what's... We've never been sure what comes from the Torah, what doesn't come from the Torah, and what comes from the rabbis. And we see that customs that obviously are discussed here in the Talmud, we don't turn over the bed anymore, you know, a lot of these things. So it's in a way a nice study of the way in which halacha changes. And that's what it is. It's true. It's true. But that's not to say that, you know, from there, I don't know that one can make a logical step to say that halacha should change. Because these changes are changes that function within a community where tradition governs the life of the community. And what happens in the modern world is that that stops working. So that a lot of what happens in modern Judaism is then, how do you make it work when it seems to not work automatically by itself? Okay? Maybe you have to dress funny. Very interesting way of dealing with this. Dress the way they dressed in the 18th century. Dress differently.
And the Orthodox.
Not Orthodox. Within Orthodoxy, these are vast differences of view. But they don't, they have to do with how do you deal with this reality in the modern world. And they don't have to do with the intellectual problem of whether religion in fact changes and adapts. Okay?
This is a very interesting section, I think, because it makes even more complicated the answer to the question, you know, what is going on in these laws of mourning? Because, let's say, in the beginning, I thought this is really about making it more comfortable for the relatives of the deceased. Then you see parts where you're really doing things to respect the deceased. Here, there are laws that are designed to respect, to give kavod to the
mourner. Yeah.
So, psychology is fascinating.
So, yeah, it's not really. And then, of course, your comment about tuma and mourning rituals prescribed to deal with something even, you know, having nothing to do with any of the three things that I mentioned. So, it's,
you could write a book on the subject. It's very interesting.
42 books.
42 books.
One would be a good start.
Yeah.
This is theologically, psychologically, it's all, and it holds together, I think. There is a...
going on at once.
Yeah, it's all going on at once. Very much so. Okay. Yes?
Does the tumor have a lifespan?
Tumor?
Yeah.
It's a funny question. Does death have a lifespan?
No, tumor.
Tumor is produced from death, right?
Boy,
it actually does. It actually does. It has both a half-life, that is correct, it has a half-life, and it has a lifespan which is based on the length of time that it takes for something to totally decompose.
So in this case-wise, we still have Derech HaKohanim in Jerusalem.
What is Derech HaKohanim in Jerusalem?
After we conquered the West Bank, we couldn't go to Jericho. If you're a Kohen, you couldn't go on the main road to Jericho because some of the Jewish cemeteries were in that area. Mm-hmm. And they didn't want the Kohanim to go through those old cemeteries.
I can't tell you for sure. I don't know the facts. But usually when those issues are raised, they're
so
raised because...
So there's a special road that's called Derech HaKohanim, you know, to bypass.
I see. Usually when those issues are raised, they're raised because, in fact, there are cemeteries that can, that have bones in them. When I say decompose, I mean there's a point at which the bones will disappear.
Completely.
Yeah. At that point, you don't have any tumor left anymore. And there's a small amount of bone that constitutes that gives off this tumor. But at a certain point, that disappears too. So my hunch, since I don't know the facts of the case, my hunch would be that they weren't doing things that made no sense, but instead that there were cemeteries that could be very old cemeteries.
Precaution, but because at that time nobody looked what's going on there.
Because if you say, for example, in Jerusalem, and I don't know for sure, but there are lots of places in Jerusalem, let's say in the, what is it called, the Wadi... It's between the Mount of Olives and the Old City, where you have those burial... Excuse me, who's there? Yanai HaMelech or somebody like that? Yeah. These mausoleums that are there. You look across to the Mount of Olives, and you see down in the valley...
Gebe'enom.
That's not Gebe'enom. No. Or Gebe'enom is also an example.
Yeah, you have Shalom.
Because Gebe'enom is full of tumma. It was full of tumma. But not today, because there are no cemeteries that we know of there, and so people will go there,
including Kohanim.
Including Kohanim, sure. Because if it's old enough, and the land of Israel is a place where things are old enough, mm-hmm. that it can be fine. So it just depends. It depends on the facts of the case.
Kohanim can't be doctors.
It's an interesting issue for Kohanim. They are, but they're interesting. There's a whole literature on that question. A whole literature on that question. For a variety of reasons. And these laws that we are reading, we will also see are, they only go so far. Because one of the classic cases of the Talmud is that a Kohen Gadol is obligated to take care of a mate mitzvah. Kohen Gadol walks in the street and sees a corpse lying there. The Kohen Gadol is required to pick up the corpse and to bring it to its proper resting place. That is totally against
the
Torah.
The concept,
it's totally against. But that's halacha. That's halacha because what eventually happens in halacha is that the halacha respects the need to take care of the dead so much that they find a loophole in order to allow even the Kohen Gadol to do that.
Robert?
Yes.
In relation to what this gentleman said about reforming over the years according to custom, the word halacha by itself means as things go. So it is not an arbitrary decision of law.
Correct.
That's your interpretation.
So now that we know the half-life and lifespan of tumor, what are the boundaries? I'm thinking in... For instance, of the World Trade Center site.
Mm-hmm. The boundaries of Tuma are the airspace above the remains. Unless it is enclosed by a physical enclosure, in which case all of the airspace within that physical enclosure becomes Tumah.
A physical enclosure being a fence or anything
like that? No, it has to have a roof on it. Has to have a roof. A fence is not enough. Has to have a roof.
So for a cemetery, the airspace above the cemetery.
Right.
And what about laterally?
lateral intestine. It just goes up.
It
doesn't
just
go
goes up. Okay, and what about in some place like the Trade Center area or after any natural disaster or?
Same thing.
But if you don't know how far the remains have been scattered?
And then that's something you have to determine the likelihood of. And the rules would go. The problems are there. Interesting, weirdo problems that you can have, which are akin to what Saul was talking about at the beginning of class. The Israelis had a problem with the flight patterns, the takeoff patterns coming out of the Ben Gurion Airport. That there is a cemetery somewhere in the vicinity there, and the flight pattern will go over the cemetery. The plane doesn't block Tuma, because the Tuma goes up and through whatever it hits. So it was raised in or I should say, there's a point of view that says the plane doesn't block Tuma. Okay? So the Israeli rabbinate actually had to deal with the problem of Kohanim on planes. On planes. And they have very nifty solutions to it. I've never seen anyone who actually observed this solution, but the final solution that they suggested was some sort of a plastic bag. Cohen puts on this plastic bag, and that's the way. But I've never seen that happen. I read about it.
By the way, they moved away from
it.
It was above the cemetery of Cholon.
It was Cholon. That's right. It was Cholon. Exactly.
It's full, and it's not. They moved away because of the noise. There was a big issue about.
I see.
So they moved.
So it became moot. The whole question. It's moot. All right. Good. So.
JFK.
Yeah, I measured
Queens
those.
Is full of cemeteries.
Oh.
So
what's
sure
the flight pattern? What's the flight pattern?
I don't know.
I think it's
go over.
That's what I think, that you go straight out to sea.
Or Newark.
Believe me, I have not checked this out. In case you thought I
did. I was documenting the remains of the World Trade Center. So I'm climbing around all the things that were the location of all of that death.
Right. So you want to know what to do? Are you a Cohen?
If I was a Cohen, that would be off limits.
Yeah, you couldn't
all
do
of that.
Correct.
Space,
you couldn't do it.
All of that stuff.
You're a Cohen. You couldn't do it.
Does it matter if the body's in a coffin or buried without a coffin?
No.
That's not
an
enclosed
space.
No.
Well, by and large, it's not a barrier. Yeah. Among other reasons, first of all, it doesn't last. It's not supposed to last. But the remains of the body will last longer than the coffin will. So there are a variety of issues.
But the coin, this is sacrificing animals. Why does it matter?
Because the Torah says, the Torah says here, it says, Lenefesh lo yitama ba'amav. A coin may not defile himself among his people. Okay? Doesn't say anything about whether sacrifices go on. Doesn't say anything about it.
So you shouldn't.
Just says that you're not allowed to do that. That's why a Cohen can't go to a cemetery. A Cohen can't go to a funeral. Correct. All of our funeral chapels here have PA systems for Kohanim to stand outside. Uh-huh. We've had this in our Zorah. I don't want to mention who they are, but we have Kohanim. And they've stood outside for funeral. I've officiated the funeral. They pipe it out, and the Kohanim stand out in the street on Amsterdam Avenue. They've had that happen a number of times.
But it's obvious in context that it's because he couldn't.
Context means absolutely nothing. Context is irrelevant. Because when the Torah says something, unless the Torah itself limits the context, it can do that. Sometimes it does do that. But otherwise, the Torah really speaks. Ex post facto, it speaks period. And in fact, the priests, the way to get around in the theory is to say, well, we don't know who the priests are anymore. Now, that's another way to do it. Well, you could say otherwise. Also, just the language here, lenefesh lo yitama bi'amav, what I said to you before, the mate mitzvah, the loophole there comes from the last word bi'amav. Bi'amav. There are limitations that the rabbis learn from that. You know, it's generally it's true, but what if it's an emergency? What if it's an emergency? You know, and that's an area of law. There are exceptions to rules, and those exceptions have to be justified on the basis of some other value that conflicts. But that value would never be that the system has changed, because the system is simply in between its functioning. It hasn't changed. It's just not functioning today. That's all. that's the logic.
The situation with the doctors who walk over.
That's what we said before.
Is that the same?
It's the same. It's the same thing. Yeah. Well, I mean, a doctor generally doesn't expect the patient to die.
But they're in the doctor is in a hospital.
Correct. 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 So the doctor realized the doctor is in there, and that a doctor can also transgress the laws of the Sabbath. And in any from community, there are doctors who are open on the Sabbath. You know, they don't take money on the Sabbath. They don't write a prescription that they don't have to write on the Sabbath. But if they had to write the prescription, they would.
So Kohen, who is a doctor, there's some way that they...
As I said, there's a whole literature on that subject.
But these days, some of the medical schools offer virtual human anatomy instead of the Kohen.
Is that right?
By and large, are trying to elect those schools and those programs. That
very interesting. Because the cadaver is the principal problem of the medical student. Then a medical student comes in and gets the cadaver, you know, 1, 2, 3, that means you're a medical student. So that's it. I had no idea that that's what's happening.
A lot of the anatomy courses now, not
in Sinai,
but not necessarily, are taught
virtually. Isn't that fascinating? Can you really learn virtually?
They virtually know anatomy. They don't really know.
It's a hands-on kind of thing, I would think. Interesting.
I'm just curious about the solution with the plastic bag in the airplane. Mm-hmm. Is it the extra layer? Why would the plastic bag...
Yes, you're right. It has to do with extra layering.
Oh, because okay, the correct. Airplane is...
Correct. It's has to do with issues of number of layers. But the solution that was obtained was a much better solution, which is not to go there. It's much easier. Okay, let's keep going. Mar Ukpa Shachiv Le Bar Chamua. Okay, Mar Ukpa Shachiv Le. Okay. Last night we counted 27 days of the Omer. Baruch Adonai Adonai, Eloheinu Melech HaOlam, Asher Kideshanu B'mitzvata V'tzivanu Al Sfirat HaOmer, Hayom Shmona Ve'esrim Yom, Shehem Arba'a Shavuot LaOmer. Shmonaves Rimu. So this is now 28 days, making 4 weeks of the Omer. 4 weeks of the Omer.
Three more to go.
So we have 3 more weeks left. Okay. Shikach. Mar Ukpa Shchiv Le Bar Chamua. It's an interesting construction here. We would say Shchiv Le, there died to him, to Mar Ukpa, Bar Chamua, the son of his father-in-law. The son of his father-in-law. So, as the English correctly says, that's his brother-in-law. Okay, but that's not the way you say it in Aramaic. There's no term for brother-in-law, or there isn't in Aramaic. There is in Hebrew. Hebrew you say geese. Modern Hebrew geese is my brother-in-law. Okay, So Mar Ugba Shiv Le Bar Chamua Savar Le Metavale Shiv Al Shloshim. And he took the point of view that he would mourn for him Shiva and Shloshim. Okay? So this was his brother-in-law. Why would he mourn for a brother-in-law? Because his wife was mourning. Exactly. His wife was mourning. His wife was a mourner. It was her brother. So the secondary would be the brother-in-law. The brother-in-law. Al Rav Huna Lagabe Ashkeche. So Rav Huna went to visit him, and he found that he was observing Shiva. He was observing Shiva. Amar Le Tsudanyata Ba'it Lamecha. Rav Huna says to him, you want to eat a mourner's meal? In other words, you don't have enough food to eat? That's the way the rabbis would needle their students. I had teachers like that too. That's the way he said it to him. Lo amru lichvod ishto ela chamiv v'chamoto. They did not say that one mourns for one's wife's relatives, except father-in-law and mother-in-law, just as we saw before. It was only to be limited then to the father of that secondary. All right, it's the father and not spreading out. Okay, the father or the son. But in this case, it would only be relevant as far as the father goes. Well, father or mother. Okay? Okay. Now, Rav Huna then goes into, he proves it from a Braita, the Tanya. Mi shemet chamiv o chamoto. If your father-in-law or mother-in-law died, eino rashai lachuf et ishto liyot kochelet viliyot poseket. Interestingly, your father-in-law and mother-in-law died, so your wife is the mourner. So we say to this guy, eino rashai lachuf et ishto, he cannot force his wife liyot kochelet to put on makeup, eyeshadow, or po keset is rouge, or put on rouge. Okay? Ella kofe mitato, rather he should overturn his own bed, venoheg ima avelut, and he should observe with her mourning. Okay, so in other words, lest you thought that a husband has any right to ask his wife to look nice for him, he has no right to do that. He has to know that he has no rights. She's a mourner, and therefore he can't tell her what to do. And in addition to that, he has to turn over his bed. So they have two beds now. He has to turn over his bed, because as she is mourning, he has to express mourning also. And of course, here, the assumption is they're in the same house too. You know, we raise that possibility whether they would be at home or even in the same room. I think the assumption is probably in the same room as well. So he has to observe mourning just the way she does. The chen he shemet chamia. Likewise, if her father-in-law or mother-in-law died, eina resha'a liot kochelet liot pokeset, she may not apply eyeshadow or rouge. Ella kofa mitata, right? She can't do any of those things because she's a mourner. She has to act as if she's a mourner. She's not really a mourner, but she has to act as if she's a mourner. She turns over her bed, v'no heget imo avelut, and she conducts herself as a mourner. V'tanya idach, and it was taught in another braita, afal pisha amru eino rashai lachuf et ishto liyot kochelet liyot pokeset, sorry. Even though what we learned above was that he cannot say to her, he can't force her to put on eyeshadow or rouge, right? Since she's a mourner. Bemit amru mozeget loakos, she is still permitted to, how can I say it? To serve him.
To serve him.
To serve him. She's still permitted to serve him. It's it's one of these brightas, he's so long to wonder what the reality was. She is permitted to pour his cup. Umatza'at lo mita, she can make his bed. Umerachetzet lo panav yadav raglav, she can wash his hands, his feet, and his face. Okay, she can do all those things. Now,
it's permitted,
okay? She wants to do it, she can do it. But there's a problem here. It's not the problem you're thinking of. It's another problem. The problem here is that it says that she makes his bed.
Yeah, if it's turned over.
If it's turned over, how could she make his bed? Okay, that's the problem in the Baraita.
That's the problem.
Says that she makes his bed. How could she make his bed? We already learned that because he's the spouse, she's mourning, he has to turn over his bed. So what does she have to make it for? How could she? We even say that she makes it? All right, so that's the problem. Kashyana hadade. There is an internal difficulty in this. It's just what we just said, okay? Rav Chisda then says, Ela lav shmamina. Rather, what we learn from this is, Kan bechami v'chamoto. In the first baraita, where we see that he has to turn over the bed, and all of that happens, that's where she's mourning for her father or mother. Okay? In the case where you mourn for a father or mother, then the spouse also has to do that mourning. The second case, which is the case where she makes the bed, that's the other possibility, which is to say, she's mourning for a brother or a sister. Or a child, let's say. And in those cases, it's different. In those cases, it's different. Okay? And he doesn't have to mourn. He doesn't have to mourn.
Well, if it's mother, father, child would also count that way.
Maybe your yes, side, maybe no, because side. The problem would be whether it's his child.
His child? He's no mourner.
Correct. He's a mourner. The question is whether he has to mourn for somebody else's child.
Right, I thought up and down counted, but collateral.
Correct. Laterally would not count. I think you're probably right, because we read originally that it's for father and mother, and also goes downward. It's both upward and downward, so we go for the child. Correct. Okay. Even though that's not what it said. I mean, it just doesn't deal with that. Kan bisha akrovin. Here we're dealing with the other relatives. Okay. Shmamina. Yes, indeed you learn that from what we read. Tanya nami hachi. It's also taught in the Baraita. Lo amru lichvod ishto ela chamiv v'chamoto bilvad. When we talk about the spouse observing mourning lichvod ishto, the husband mourning for the honor of the wife, that's only ela chami v'chamoto. That is limited to the father-in-law and the mother-in-law. In other words, her parents. Okay. Amemar shechiv le barbere. The son of Amemar's son died. So that, in other words, is Amemar's grandson. Amemar's grandson died. Kara ilave. Amemar made kriya for that death. Ata bere karabi ape. Right? His son, the deceased father. That's interesting. This is going to say something differently than what I just said in response to you, Reed. Bre karabiape, his son, the deceased father, then comes, and Amemar tears his garment again.
Why?
Because, no, it's not different. It's the same. Because now he's in his presence. We learned always that, in fact, the one who is either the going up or down, in either way, when you're mourning like that, so if it's your grandchild that has died, it's limited to biape, the fanav, in the same place. The same place, because you can then leave that place and there's no requirement of mourning. So here, that's what he... So first he did it without him being there. Then he comes again and he realizes he's now he really has to do it. The first time he didn't really have to do it. He shouldn't have done it. Then he really has to do it. Okay? Idkar d'miyushav kara. He then remembers, he realizes that this second time he made Kriya sitting down. He made Kriya sitting down. Kam karamu mat. He then stood up and made Kriya a third time. So the truth is, all he had to do was make Kriya once. That one time, he should have made it standing up.
In his son's presence.
In his son's presence. Yeah. Correct. In his son's presence. And instead, he made two mistakes. All right. Finally, by the third time, he gets it right. Third time, he got it right. That's an, you know, that's the way the Gemara will teach, is to give you a story like this.
I've heard about Kriya standing up.
It's the first time we've heard about it. Correct. Absolutely. That is the first time, and that's going to start the discussion now. Why do you have to make Kriya standing up? Okay? That's the first time we've seen that Kriya has to be made standing up. Okay? Here you say, Amar le Rav Ashi le Ameimar. Rav Ashi then says to Ameya, Kriya d'me'umad minalan. From what scriptural source do we learn that Kriya has to be made while standing up? First of all, let's step back a minute. I should really say something about Kriya. Well, let's finish this. We'll just go to the end of the page here. Where does it say that it has to be made standing up? Dichti vayakam iyo vayikra et mi'ilo. After Job's sons die, it says, and Job got up and he rent his coat. He rent his coat. Okay? So it says that he got up. It says, the text says that he got up.
Job wasn't Jewish.
Doesn't make any difference. The Talmud doesn't know that he wasn't Jewish. Some people in the Talmud say he wasn't. Some people say he was. Some people say he was Moshe Rabbeinu. So a variety of points of view here. So, first of all, what does Kriya mean? That we shouldn't pass over without thinking about. Kriya means the rending of a garment. And it means what it says. It means rending a garment. It does not mean what most people think it means. Most people think it means wearing something that is rent, like, for example, a ribbon that's placed on the garment. That is totally wrong. There's no halacha for that whatsoever. It is totally unhalachic. Kriya means rending an actual garment. And at this point, we see that you have to rend the garment, you have to rend it standing up. We'll have a lot of information further on that chapter about the details of Kriya and of the garments that have to be torn from Kriya. But we're really talking about the actual rending of a garment. It's fascinating to see the history of this thing. Some of you who have, where we've dealt with this in your own families, know that I always explain to a family that Kriya means the rending of a garment. Some people find that uncomfortable, they don't want to do it, and they therefore tear a ribbon. That became common in America before my time. I don't know what the history of that is. It would be a really good an article in the American Jewish Sociology to write about the tearing of a ribbon. There's no halacha to that whatsoever. It's clearly wrong. And as far as I can see, must have been connected to the affluence of the community, which is the opposite of what one would normally think. The more affluent the community became, the less it was willing to tear its garments. Mm-hmm. When people were poor, they tore their garments. When they got to be rich,
that makes sense, though.
They wouldn't tear their garments.
It's silly, but it makes sense.
So what's the logic?
Sorry?
What's the logic?
Become fussy when you're affluent.
Expensive suit.
It has more value to you. Yeah.
It's more valuable to you. You place more value on it.
Right.
You place. It has less value.
It's more expensive. It's more expensive.
But relatively speaking, a poor man has one shirt. That's worth $1 million to him. I mean,
that it seems true. But
people who have 100 shirts. What?
He's less attached to it.
Correct. So it's very interesting that has happened. What I suspect is that we're going to see that changing. I've already seen it changing in the last 10 years. It used to be that when you would say that, people would actually be offended. They would be offended at the thought of tearing your garment. I found today most young people want to do that.
Yeah, but when you go to a funeral of your parents or you come with a shirt that you allow to tear, and that's
what I always say to people. I say, you know, we're going to tear a garment. You should therefore think about it in terms of how you get dressed tomorrow. You know, I don't want to suddenly pull this on you. Think about it ahead of time so that you tear a garment that you're comfortable tearing.
And when do you do the tearing?
We do the tearing. And it's apparently fairly universally done before you begin a chapel service. Before you begin the service.
Okay, so when you're... Oh.
So it is done before the service, and I think we brought this up once before. Ron, you said it was also in Israel.
Yeah,
we've done the same way.
Before they start, when they do the tekes hashkava, when the body is there and everyone is under the same roof,
In Israel, you don't have funeral chapels. They do it at the cemetery. It's close to the cemetery.
I've done it at the graveside. I've seen it done at the graveside.
Well, we do it at graveside if it's a graveside ceremony. If you don't have a funeral chapel part of your the service, many people have a graveside service, in which case you do it graveside. But if you have a chapel service out beyond the cemetery, I've always seen it done there. And as I say, the times you see it done at graveside is when that's where the service is. Okay?
I don't know if we're going to read about this, but does it have to be a garment next to your skin?
We'll read about that. The answer is yes and no. Depends.
Because these people have to get into their jacket.
Correct. But it's not so simple. It's frequently done with a jacket, it's frequently done with a shirt, it's frequently done with a tie, it's done with a sweater. Those are the things that are most frequently done, but actually the law is more complicated.
Is it supposed to be something that you're going to wear for 7 days?
Correct.
Wear a tie.
Yep. You wear it during the Shiva. You wear the Kriya during the Shiva. There's a whole literature, and we'll say more about that as we get more into this. There's a whole literature on which garment you tear, which you're allowed to tear, and the very strong feelings in the literature, pro or con to certain types of garments.
The black ribbon was already established in what was then considered the Orthodox community, and not necessarily an affluent part of the Orthodox community.
Sorry, how far back?
In
the 50s? Very interesting.
I don't know. I don't know how it originated. I think it was part of the whole assimilation kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. But do you have any information that before that it was common to tear a garment? I can't imagine that in 19th century Europe they regularly tore garments.
Oh, they always did. Always did.
So is that just common knowledge? Or
it would say in the legal literature that it would be mentioned if it were not done. It's always assumed that you tear a garment. There's never an assumption otherwise until fairly recently.
So post-World War II, you're saying the literature begins to talk about the ribbon.
Correct. It's post-World War II that you begin to get this discussion. That's when I know the discussion. I don't really know, as I say, it'd be an interesting discussion in American Jewish sociology, and as far as I know, it's only an American phenomenon. I don't know that any other Jewish community anywhere in the world has had this type of Kriya. I think it's only an American phenomenon.
It may predate the early 1950s.
It's possible.
I know that by that time it did.
It's possible. Well, I can't imagine. I don't know the Orthodox community, and I just wonder about the non-Orthodox community. Even that'd be a fascinating thing to study. Orthodox and non-Orthodox burials and Kriya procedures in the early 20th century, let's say, from the time that the American Jewish community gets established. I wonder whether we have literature on that. Very interesting to study. There's a lot of things, even the whole use of the Chevra Kadisha. I don't know, we got an article last night at the Chevra Kadisha meeting that the chairperson, one of the chairpersons of our committee, had an article from Rabbi Zone, who is one of the key players in the Chevra Kadisha world, which I read this morning, which is a very interesting article about the tensions in the American Jewish community about Chevra Kadisha in the Orthodox world. Orthodox were against Chevra Kadisha, and then there was the opposite. It was super Chevra Kadisha, and there's a lot of tension within American Orthodoxy. And that's all changed in the last 25 years.
They did Tahara at home. Mm-hmm. A person died at home. Mm-hmm. They did it at home.
Yeah, I would imagine they would.
You know, I mean, what I had heard, family things, that in the 1930s, which, you know, was not that ancient, that they did Tahara at home.
Because you really have two choices before you have the funeral chapel. You have either home or the cemetery. If the Israeli cemeteries, and the cemeteries I think in South America, are built so that you can do Tahara as you go into the cemetery, it's another way of handling it. But I don't think there's any American cemetery that was built that way. It probably has to do with the history of the American Jewish community. Our community, and probably the first cemeteries that we have here in New York, were all done by the German Jews. I assume the basic setup was probably provided by the German Jewish community.
Well, the first one was the Sephardim.
Correct, the Sephardim. I don't know anything about the Sephardim. The Sephardim were not the way they are today. You have to remember that, too. If you read Professor Sarna's book on American Judaism, one of the fascinating things which I learned from that book was that the American Sephardim were not the way we think of them as being Orthodox. In the early days of Sheirat Israel in New York, they didn't have a Sefer Torah. I mean, there were all kinds of things that were just different than what we would expect today. But all that changed in the course of history.
Is the assumption that after you wear this rent garment, you won't wear it again after the Shiva?
No.
Or you can wear it again?
You can definitely wear it again. Because the assumption was to the contrary, that people only had one or two garments. The time of the Talmud, people don't have wardrobes.
We discuss what to do in case you don't have, you have no garment.
We could borrow one. Correct. All this in the Talmud.
Was there ever a time that Kriya was not postponed? It was done at the moment.
Yes, it was. There was a time when that was done, when it was done at the moment of death. When it was not postponed. That was definitely a part of the development of Kriya, was to do it at the moment of death.
And is there an issue about where on the garment you rend, depending on who you are?
Yep.
Where did that come from?
It's from the Talmud. Where were it's all here. Okay, let's go a little further. Amale Rav Ashi Lameimar Kriya D'me'umad Minaylan Dichti Vayakam Iyo Vayikra Et Mi'ilo. Right, there's the verse from Job, which says, Job got up and tore his garment. Ella, Rav Ashi then says, Me'ata, if that's the kind of biblical analysis that you do, reading that kind of a verse, how about where it says, V'amad v'amar lo chafatzti lakachta hachinami? Where the Torah in the book of Deuteronomy talks about the laws of chalitza. You know what chalitza is? Chalitza is a situation where a man dies. He's married to a woman. They have had no children. He dies childless. According to the Torah, his brother is required to marry that widow so that she can then produce a child. She can have a child which is, according to the Torah, on the name of the husband. Comes from the brother. The brother is required to do that. That's in the Torah. This whole procedure changes by the time of atonement. And the Torah itself talks about, well, if the brother doesn't want to fulfill that obligation, she has to go over to him and she takes off his shoe and she spits at him. It's a humiliating procedure.
So she saves face, too.
She saves face, and she humiliates him because he's not willing to have his family responsibility. He's not doing his thing, right. So that's in that context, it says, V'amad v'amar, and he stood up and he said, Lo chafatzte lakachta, I wish not to marry her. Right? He doesn't want to marry his brother's wife. So it says, V'amad v'amar. And he stood up and he said. So, Rav Ashi is saying, if you take every time in the Torah where it says, and he stood up and he said, and you say it means he has to stand up, V'hatanya, we know from a Baraita, Yoshev ben omed, ben Yoshev ben omed, ben muta. When you make chalitza, you can be standing, sitting, or leaning, according to the laws of chalitza. So, that shouldn't be. If the Torah says, V'amad v'amar, and he stood and he said, you have to be consistent in your interpretation. How can you interpret it in one place and say it means you have to stand? In another place, it doesn't mean you have to stand. Right? So that's not a good proof that you brought to me. That's a good biblical interpretation. Okay. Amar Lei, he says to him, Hatam lo ketiv v'ya'amod v'yomar. It doesn't say it as if this is consecutive action, that he should be doing this. Rather, it simply says the past tense. Look at what it said up, v'amad v'amar. It simply tells us what happened. Doesn't mean that he has to do it. When you change something in the past tense to Hebrew, it becomes a... when you turn to the future tense, in modern Hebrew, for example, if you say... get up. How can you say get up? You could say it two ways. You could say kum, and what else could you say?
Takum.
Okay.
Or amod.
Correct. But let's say you say... you could say amod, or you say ta'amod. We say that in the Torah readings. We say Ya'amod. 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 Ya'amod is not Tzivui.
Ta'amod.
Amod is Tzivui. But the Hebrew usage is such that we use the future tense also for the Tzivui, for the command tense.
Aliyah, you say
Ya'amod. Exactly. And in Aliyah, you say Ya'amod. Let him stand up. Let him stand up. Okay, that's also. Using the future tense for a tzivui. Right? So here, the answer is, Amar lehatam lokati v'yamod v'yomar. The formulation in the book of Deuteronomy is not in the future tense. It's not written like that. Hacha kati v'yakam v'yikra. That is in the future tense in the book of Job. Okay? So it's different. It's not the same thing. And therefore, it can be understood to be a command. Okay? Amarami Barchama, Minayin li kriya shehi mu'umad. How do we learn that kriya has to be made standing? Shenemar vayakam iyo vayikra. Another source that says, Job got up and he rent his garment. Okay? Now, don't think that that's the end of the discussion. Just because you have two proofs doesn't mean that it's right, because we will see that this kind of grammatical argument is not such a strong argument.
Yes. When I was in high school in Israel, there was a member of the staff who was a Yemenite Jew, and he came to Palestine with his wife, children, a brother, a married brother without children. The brother died in Israel. The British did not allow polygamy, except if he would have come to Israel with already two wives, they would have let it be. That's based on all Ottoman law. What he did is, he divorced his wife. He married his brother's widow, gave her a son, divorced her, and married his first wife again. And the child was brought up by effectually the aunt.
Uh-huh.
Nope. But the Yemenites only knew the Torah.
Uh-huh.
They were not educated further than the Torah.
No,
so
they were.
They took the Torah more literally.
The Yemenites accepted the Rambam as the law. They did not accept the Shulchan Aruch, but they accepted the Rambam. The Mishneh Torah was their source of law. So these traditions still are with us today. Today you are required to give chalitza. There's no option. In Jewish law today, since we do not permit polygamy, you are required to give chalitza.
It's automatic.
It's automatic that you have to do it, but you have to do it.
I think in conservative life in Israel, you don't need to do anything. It's maybe only in the Orthodox.
Yeah.
I think you don't need to go to the Rabbanut for that.
Very good. Okay, to be continued.
Thank you.